You're listening to Rendezvous with a Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet, and story is everything. We're your hosts tonight, Jim and Bobby Bell.
And we're delighted that you're joining us again this week. That was the Hot Texas Swing Band, our good friends, starting the show off with a little bit of a song called Hot Texas. And we're delighted that you're joining us, whether you're here live or you're joining us later on the podcast through Podbean and Spotify and Amazon Music and LA Talk Radio, wherever you are, we are so happy that you're with us.
We are.
Hey, who's our guest tonight?
Hey, special guest, Gina L. Carroll. And we're going to be talking about the grandest garden.
Hello, Gina. Welcome.
Hello.
We love this book.
Yay.
And we love this cover, and we can't wait to get talking about it. Where are you joining us from?
I'm joining you from San Marino, California.
That's exciting.
Yeah. Nearby one of the most beautiful gardens that there is.
Yes, the Huntington Libraries. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes.
I am.
It is a joy and a privilege to be so close to that wonderful place.
Such We've been there a couple of times, but a long time ago,
but
right?
A long time. Yeah. But we can picture it, and we can picture kind of where you are in San Marino in connection to it. So we feel like neighbors, even though we're across the miles. Yeah. And we're delighted that you're with us.
Yeah. I am delighted to be here. Very excited.
That's good.
Yeah. Jim has a little introductory bio. Do you want to go ahead and get
read
to that,
Jim? Yeah, sure.
And then we can get started.
Do it.
Okay, Gina began writing, blogging, and speaking after leaving a large corporate law practice to raise her five children. She founded Storyhouse, LLC, a writing, editing, and authorship services company based on the belief that the storytelling universe needs more authentic and diverse voices. She is most proud of the debut story, house publishing effort, Stories Are Medicine, Writing to Heal, an anthology, a beautiful offering from a committed group of Black women, writers from Houston and beyond. The Grandest Garden is her debut novel. Welcome.
We are so delighted to have you with us, and I'd mentioned to you when we chatted a little bit the other day that when Grace Fell sent information to us about this book, we just knew right away, like, okay, we have to find a spot and bring her on the calendar. This just released, didn't it? Not long ago.
It did. June 4th.
Yeah. And you had a special book signing. You had an opening event, I think, didn't you? I saw on your website. What was it like?
It was the best. You know, I was sharing with friends that maybe I'm not ambitious enough, because this book event, which was 2 days after the book published, was so lovely. I was like, this is good. I'm done. I don't need any, you know, it can't get any better than this. It was really, really wonderful. Wonderful crowd. And we were in a garden. The weather was perfect, which is, you know, hit or miss in Houston. So yes, it was lovely.
Yeah.
I think there has to be something memorable about a first, you know, all of the firsts that happen in a writer's life, including that kind of an event. Yeah. So there is so much to talk about with this book. Okay, so let me
Don't you give us just a couple moments about your background?
Yeah. Tell us a little more.
Okay. I'll continue from your nice efficient bio. Thank you for that. So Yes, this is my first work of fiction. I have written and published two previous books, both nonfiction, both really about helping folks get their best stories written and told. One I wrote when I was, you know, I have five children, when I was in the midst of raising my children and my older ones were in high school. I wrote a book about social media and how to use social media for good and not evil. How to get your best stories online to help you get into college.
Yeah.
My second book was about why and how to write your life stories. And I really sort of have a fun approach to doing that helps folks get started and finish. Yeah.
I think a lot of us probably have journals half started and notebooks in various drawers and boxes and things that we went through a period of life and we thought, oh, I should be keeping track of this. And then who has time, or it was on a computer and that computer's long gone and we never printed it and we never,
Yes.
All those challenges of how we keep track. You call yourself a story wrangler.
I do.
Love that term. Tell us how you came up with that and what does that mean to you?
And I love that Texas theme to start off the show, by the way. Thank you very much for that. along with the wrangler theme, given that I'm mostly in Houston these days. Texas, I consider myself a story wrangler because my business is about helping folks recognize that they've got a story to tell, first of all. So as you mentioned, there are lots of you out there who write a little bit, you journal. I really think that readers, avid readers like yourselves, are really closet writers. I really do. There's also folks out there who don't know they should be writing. They don't think their stories are important enough. They're afraid that they're not good enough of a storyteller. And so part of what I do is to bring people to that notion that their stories are worthy and they should be writing them and they should be sharing them.
Mm-hmm. No, that's great. Because I'm sure there are a lot of people who think, oh, I want to, but,
I know. Or they'll say, this is not important. These stories aren't important. But we also know as sort of historians is that those stories that people thought that about, when they show up in diaries and historical societies and things, it's like those are the stories we're looking for, how to get the flesh on the bone, put the life between the hyphen of birth date and death date and what was really going on that day to day actually is important.
Yes.
And it is kind of up to all of us to share. To share that piece.
Do you run into some people, in this area that maybe are afraid to write because they've got a lot of criticism from friends or family members or something like that? So they've made them a little skitterish?
Yes. Yeah. And as wide open as the writing and publishing world is right now, there's so many ways to write. There's so many ways to get your stories out there. Yeah. There's also a real risk of criticism. Social media is tough.
There's lots of ways
that once you put yourself out there, it feels very, very dangerous. It takes a little bit of bravery. That's true. But I do truly believe that there's someone for everyone's story,
When did you start writing seriously?
I started, seriously. Oh, what is that? What is
No, when did you start writing?
So I like to say that I've always had sort of an interest in writing. I wrote this little story for my high school newspaper, and it was a little piece of fiction, and I submitted it sort of sheepishly, and it was published and sort of had a wonderful response, and I was a little bit hooked at that point. But I came around to it after law school, after probably my third child. I was no longer practicing law and really feeling like I needed to use my brain for something. And so I did start to write. And I think I shared that my favorite place to write, one of my most accessible places, was in the carpool line waiting to pick my kids up for school. It was just me in the car. It was quiet. I was sitting there. And so I started to do some freelance writing. And that's where I started.
Yeah. It's finding those little blocks of time, isn't it? and making them have value. And then you were doing some blogging, I think, too, weren't you? Kind of before any of us knew what that was all about.
I was an early blogger. And when it was just low risk and you really didn't think anybody was reading, right? Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I really think is important is that you not just write, but you write with the intention to share. And blogging sort of allowed you the that step of sort of releasing your writings out into the world. And because it felt like the world wasn't paying attention, it was easy in those days. And then as it got on and, you know, and your blogs gained attention. I was writing about parenting. Because, you know, I was in the middle of it. And so I think I'm considered an early mommy blogger. But yes, that's when I started blogging.
And then when did Story House make its way into your life?
So Story House happened after the book, after the Story That Matters book was published. And that business was a way for me to follow the book with action. As I said, I believe everyone should write. And so I started to make myself available to help folks get their stories out there. I started workshops and forming writing groups to sort of bring people to this notion that they should be writing. I have a little approach in that book that makes it a little bit easier. And it's not a secret. I'm happy to tell you that when you think about writing about your life, it's this colossal thing, like your whole life, from birth to where you are now. It's a lot. It's big. It's a little too big. It's intimidating. But the truth is, your life is made up of all these little stories, and you tell one story at a time. And so you look at the seminal times in your life. You know, your birth, the stories of your parents, because the stories of your parents are not their story. It's your story of them. It's not your story, your career and professional, you know, stories, all your romantic and relationship stories. So there are all these little stories that you write and then you put it together. And it can be a biography. It could be a memoir for just a short period of time in your life. It can take on many forms, but start one story at a time that gets you started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you find that, as people do this, like I look back over my life and there truly are whole years. I have no memory of what really happened there. I might know, oh, I was working at this place then. But as I'm getting older, I'm like losing track of those things. And I wonder if I began to write, if some things would come back to me that I've just sort of said, oh, that wasn't, you know, important. Do you find that with writers? Is that something people share with you?
I do think that happens. I think that it takes some real intentional mining of your memories if you're going to talk about the past. Let me tell you something. There were people there in your life and they have their own version.
I'm not sure I'd want to hear it.
So, you know, sometimes you can ask the folks you trust, but sometimes you gather pictures.
Yeah.
You know, you look and see what music was of that era.
Yes.
And remember what you were doing and who you were spending time with and, you know, where you were and what kinds of things were important to you. Then you sort of mine these things around that time and it starts to come back.
Yeah.
It's a good way to think about it.
It is. Yeah. We are, this is the perfect spot to just take a quick break. We do want our listeners to find out where they can get Gina's book, The Grandest Garden, as well as all of the books of our featured guests on Rendezvous with the Writer. So we're going to take just a little short break about our Out West Shop affiliate page on bookshop.org. I'm going to be right back and Gina's going to read to us. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story. We had just a little blip to take. We are live. So thank you for hanging out, staying with us. We are with our guest, Gina Carroll, and we're talking about her book, The Grandest Garden. Gina, did you want to read a little something for us?
I'd love to. And I've decided to read chapter 11. Nan. Actually, you know what? I'm going to go before Nan and the Big Move, and I'm going to go to chapter 8. Nan and the Fall.
Okay.
And the Fall, okay.
Nan and the Fall, yep. Yes. We paused to survey the blossoms, seeking just the right candidates for the Sunday dinner table bouquet. It's warm, but the late morning sun is overcast. I take a deep breath in. The air is humid, still, and thick with the smell of soil and Estee Lauder perfume. I'm holding Nan's hand when we cross the patches of lawn to the garden path. The dew on the grass makes the tips of our shoes wet, and the damp pebbles on the path clump together to form slippery mounds around our steps. We'll cut some Dutch iris, Nan says, stopping in front of the cluster of tall, mature flowers. Nan looks them over, assessing them. Do you see the Dutch iris, Bella? Nan asks. Mm. Yes, ma'am, I answer, confused by the question. Of course I see the irises right in front of us. These are the clusters I helped Mr. Blackshear prune last spring when the bulk of the older plants threatened to spill over onto the path. We were following Nan's orders. She could not abide, she said, this kind of disorder. Leggy stems and spent blossoms bending beyond their borders. I don't say, of course, I see them out loud, but perhaps my expression does. No, Nan says. I mean, have you really looked at the Dutch iris? To truly see them, dear one, first you must close your eyes. Nan closes her eyes and turns her face up to the sky, just as the clouds clear and the garden is bathed in the sun's commanding light. She smiles into the warmth and holds her breath. Do you feel a breeze of any kind? She asks. No, ma'am, I say. Now my eyes are closed. My face turns skyward, too. I only see bright orange through my eyelids. I'm concentrating, but the air in the garden is stock still. So then, Nan says, look at the irises now. I open my eyes and focus them on the path of blossoms. I see that they are swaying ever so slightly and haphazardly, some leaning north and then south, some west and then east, like a crowd of teenagers moving to their own beat. Are they doing that on their own? I ask. Yes, they are speaking to us, Bella, letting us know that they see us too. Perhaps this late in their season, it's their last dance. It is late fall and the blossoms are sparse, but this variety is a colorful mix of blue, lavender, and purple. Thank you, beautiful ladies, for allowing us this gift, Nan says. She does a short curtsy, her arms outstretched. The dancing irises seem to sway a touch more, this way and that, an acknowledgement of Nan's gesture. She turns and reaches for the step stool she uses when she's ready to take cuttings. Who else will we cut today, Nanny? I want to thank someone, I say, enjoying this ritual of honoring the flowers before they become our table dressing. Just the irises, Nan says. They alone will go well with your mother's dinner. My mother is making smothered pork chops with purple cabbage coleslaw, a family favorite. Yes, but can we put them in the yellow vase, the one you usually save for the Midas touch tulips? At 12, I've developed an interest in the dinner table flower arrangements, usually Nan's only Sunday dinner task. Well, now, dear, you know that very special vase is only for my very special tulips. Nan pauses, reconsiders. But yes, we can. That will be a beautiful combination. The Midas touch, so bright yellow they look like shiny gold coins, are Nan's favorite tulip variety. But the bulbs aren't even planted yet. Refrigerator, since the Southern California cold is not always cold enough to result in a hearty springtime display. I decide the iridescent yellow vase is too pretty to ignore for an entire season. I run to the west side of the garden behind the garage to the potting shed to grab the shears. I race back. Nan turns and catches me mid-sprint. Do not run with those shears, Bella. You know better, she says, with a sharpness in her tone that stops me in my tracks. I stand on the path and hold up the shears to show that I am at least holding them properly. Blades down, handles up. Nan sees that I have grabbed the wrong ones. No, no, dear. Get the pruners with the red handle, she calls out. I return to the shed, and just as I exchange one tool for the other, Nan yells out, Bella! I turn, but I do not see her. She is not where she was. She calls out again, Bella? This time it is a question, and then a moan that barely escapes her throat. I drop the pruners and run to the path. She is down, lying on her side and holding her left thigh with both hands. I run to her, screaming for my father. When I look up to the house, I see that my mother is already through the sliding glass doors and standing on the veranda. Her eyes are big round circles, and her face is even more ashen than my grandmother's. She's not moving. Nan screams in pain. With every scream, I yell out for my father, who finally pushes past the statue that is my mother and runs to us. Edie, call 911, my father says. Edie! He is trying to break through to my mother, who finally runs into the house. Dad and I are listening to hear she picks up the phone in the family room, but we do not hear the sounds that we should, the lifting of the receiver and her voice, and she does not return. After what feels like an eternity, Bernard appears at the door. Bern, go see if your mother is calling 911, Dad says as he sits down behind Nan and eases her back onto his thighs. She is still gripping her leg. There now, Miriam, try not to move. Let's just sit tight. I'm sitting on my haunches beside her. I touch her shoulder, but every time she cries out, I draw my hand back. Did you see what happened, Bella? Dad asks me. No, I was at the potting shed. I tripped, David, over the blasted stool, Nan says. Her voice is a mixture of disgust and anguish, her breathing labored, like she's been running laps. I'm feeling a little queasy, David, Nan says between gasps. Breathe, Miriam, Dad says. Deep breaths in and out, in through your nose, out through your mouth. Slow, slow. Nan closes her eyes and follows Dad's instructions. She seems calmer for a moment, but with the slightest move, she shrieks in pain. Now I'm feeling queasy too. I take in gulps of air. We hear the sirens in the distance. Bernard appears at the veranda. They're coming, he says. Go out front and show them back, my father says, and get your mother. Leave Edie be, Nan says. Just leave her be.
Mm. That's quite a passage. Gina,
this is, we have been treated to.
That's a great job of reading, too.
Oh, my
Thank
goodness.
You.
We have been treated to the author reading from this fabulous book. And so, dear listeners and watchers, imagine every page of this book filled with that type of prose that just gets you. You see it, you can taste it, you can feel it. This is a book that is truly a garden of delight. And thank you so much, Gina, for sharing that chapter with us.
Oh my goodness.
There's so much covered in that chapter, isn't there?
There is. And you've read it, so you know it's a bit of a turning point.
It is.
That's true.
It is.
Gina, what was the inspiration that got you started on this story? And if you worked a long time on it.
I did. You know, I had this pretty idyllic childhood with two very involved grandmothers and deeply devoted grandfathers also. And so this relational dynamic is really appealing to me to sort of examine. As I maybe mentioned before when we talked, my grandmothers were not gardeners. But I really feel like the way they cultivated the kinds of things we did together and the things that they taught us was really like planting seeds and cultivating a garden. So that sort of became symbolic of.
Sundays are very big days for Bella with her grandmothers. Yes. Was Sunday a day for you as well with your grandparents?
Not really, until I had my own family and my parents moved to our same city. They are here in Southern California. They moved to Houston to be near their grandchildren, and they instituted Sunday dinner. So every Sunday we went, my family went, and my brother's family, to dinner at my parents'. And, and so, yes, that tradition is sort of reflected here.
Was that a real fun time, that dinner get together?
It was a great time.
That's good.
First of all, my mother is a better cook than I. it's an opportunity for them to be around other caring adults, other than, you know, the parents who they're really tired of having to listen to. And and it was extremely special for my parents as well.
And on Sundays, tea is often partaked. And Nan's veranda, the veranda is as magical as the garden, I think, in over in Nan's world. Yes. But they do enjoy, Bella does enjoy tea with her grands. And are you a tea drinker as well?
I am. And I love a good tea service.
There you go. There you go.
The tea service. Yeah.
I know, it's kind of fun. In the book, she learns they use tea bags, and then later on, she kind of learns that there's some other ways to do tea.
Right. They upgrade themselves. They keep learning. That's right.
Now, the story takes place as the writer writes it. We get thens and nows. And
yes.
So we go sort of back and forth. And we're on the East Coast and we're on the West Coast.
Yes.
As a writer, I'm always curious when we have those thens and nows. Did you, as you crafted this story, kind of write out all the thens and then write out all the nows and figure out how to meld them? Or did you write just as we read it?
I started with the thens. But the nows were always the string of her development, right? I did not finish the thens before I endeavored to begin on the nows. And I didn't write the book linearly either. So the answer to that is no, I didn't write one timeline exclusively. But I did start with the thens.
Yeah. So did you kind of write, because they're like scenes, in a way, and you could probably shuffle them around. Did you find that you did that?
I did. When you know, you've got things going and you've got an order, and then say you've got an add a character. Right. So then the shuffle happens all over again, because how they fit in, and as you add to the storyline. So there was a lot of shuffling. And honestly, I also changed the tenses as well. I played with that Bella's voice in the first person, and the narrator's voice for the now. I sort of played with that to see what felt right for the story.
Mm-hmm. How did you pick New York City? In East Village.
Yes, I love New York City. I've never lived there, but I have three daughters, and two of them moved to the East Village as young adults after college.
Okay.
They decided to live together. I'd never had any experience with the East Village, but I loved it. I felt a real connection to that city, even though it is very much kind of a young person's part of town over there. And so when it was just natural for me for her, when she was leaving Los Angeles to go to New York. She wants to be an artist. She needs to go where the action is. And
the Village is quite a place. It's been around. It said, state of a mind kind of thing for 70, 80, 90 years.
Oh, yeah.
And it wasn't always just a young person's place.
No.
So it's went from poets to writers to folk musicians, to rock folks.
Fertile ground.
Yeah, it's got quite a history. And what's left there is really quite wonderful. You're right, Bobby. It's very, very fertile ground. Yeah. Especially for a young person, sort of. So for my, I don't know if that's true. Yes, for my at least younger daughter who moved there, it was her first New York experience. And I think these villages are pretty cool.
Is she still there? Are they still there, the two of them?
She is married now, but she's in New Jersey. She works for an urban garden.
I was just going to say.
There you go.
She's not a gardener. She's a farmer.
She's real serious.
Yeah, she's the real deal.
So the gardens are characters in this book. And of course, we learned about Nan's garden and that wonderful, the Dutch iris. That whole scene is fabulous. And Gran's garden. Mm. And then we have the community garden. And the gardens kind of pop out the very, very first chapter of the book. We are with Bella and her mom, her very first day in her brand new apartment. You're not brand new, but in her apartment in the East Village. And they're up on the roof where she can imagine a roof garden. And it's New Year's Eve. And if anybody has ever watched, even if you're just watching on TV about New York on New Year's Eve, oh, my goodness. And I thought, what a way to start the story. It's not a spoiler alert. That's how it starts.
That's right.
We are gripped immediately in that opening chapter. And I could not put the book down. I just had to know what's going to happen next.
Did it grab you? It grabbed you.
I had to get a blanket to put on. You know, it's 100 degrees outside, but it's -10 in New York.
Did you do some research on effects of cold water on folks? Because you were quite descriptive in some of the scenes when they were on the roof, you know. They stayed out. Yeah.
I'll tell you something. When I was working with a draft of this book, I had it workshopped with a writing group. Mm-hmm. And the folks who were from the West Coast were like, oh, yeah, that's a really good scene. And the folks who were from the East Coast were like, that's not cold enough to be a good scene. They're not going to die in that temperature. They've got plenty of time. You know,
that answers your question.
So I had to, you know, it's not enough to say, well, they're Californians. So to them, you know, 30 degrees, they think they're going to die. And so I did have to say, okay, so what temperature becomes significant? You know, how much time do you have? And then what's happening to you when that's, you know? So yes, in short, I did.
There must have been a number of things you really had to research, because we feel like we are gardeners along with Bella and the others that garden, the other characters that garden. Ellen and the Asima, and you know, there's other gardeners in the story, and she's a photographer. Tell us a little bit about Bella. She's an amazing character. You can't not love Bella. There's just everybody just gotta love Bella.
Well, I wanted her to be an artist, and I love photography, and I thought it would be a fun form medium. To work with, because it gives her, you know, it's a little bit more flexible. She's starting her life, so it's not an expensive, you know, like she doesn't need, you know, canvases and paints. And I just felt like it fit her journey. And I love photography. So it was a fun thing to really sort of get familiar with.
Well, and it's a lovely way for us to follow her. You know, if she worked in a restaurant or a retail operation or something, it wouldn't be nearly the same. She's an artist and photography artist, but she's also makes her living taking pictures of events and things. And she's really good. There is a wedding scene that is just... I was laughing. I was gasping, you know, and so she's on the floor. She's here. Yes. She's there. She's everywhere. How did you figure out what she, where and where she needed to be in that scene?
Well, I love that chapter because I started with a ridiculous notion. Like you have this bridezilla who insists on having seven photographers. Like who does that? And what would that look like to just have this extravagant wedding and so extravagant that you need seven photographers? And I think I was making a little bit of a statement about how important, you know, having every angle of every picture is these days. So you already have, if she had 500 guests in her wedding, she already has 500 cameras there.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And so to sort of accentuate the reality of how photographs have sort of taken over that whole wedding experience, this notion of formally bringing on seven photographers, you know, and then what would one photographer do when there's seven people that are vying for the pictures? And so it was just a really fun exercise.
Well, she's just really spunky. She's not intimidated.
No.
She has been named the bride's photographer, but still, she's not going to let anybody, you know, she's just, I'm in my zone. I know what I need to do. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. She's got a great assistant who's so fun. Gina.
Very confident.
Not yeah. Gina. Yeah. You're Gina. What's Bella? The Bella's assistant.
Bella. Oh, Jerry.
That's it, Jerry. Yes. Yes. Yeah, they're very fun together. All the scenes with the two of them are very fun.
We need to talk about a couple other characters. We're moving pretty quick here.
I can't believe we're all, yeah. Are you having fun? I hope you're having fun.
I am. Of course I am.
Okay, you have to tell us. We're gonna throw out a few character names and you can tell us what you like. Please talk about Drip.
Drip. So Drip, I think maybe I shared that of all sort of the feedback I've gotten, reviews and feedback, everyone is really unhappy with me and Drip.
We
want more Drip.
More, oh, okay. More Drip. More Drip.
Wonderful character. Man, yep. I love him too. And I just will share that this story continues. And he, you know, there will be more of Drip, but really he really was to represent sort of this reality that Bella is the realization she comes to that this man that she has moved across the country in reliance on is not who he said he was. Mm-hmm. He's not quite the owner of a gallery who can make the decisions to make her the famous photographer like he has represented. Mm-hmm. And so Drip is sort of that final piece where this is his only other client and he's not really quite, you know, his client yet. So that really was why Drip was introduced. But as that character developed, I really was sort of having fun with making him sort of this unexpected contender. You know, you think we've got a Team Dorian, Team Bradford situation going. And so then where does this Drip come in? Is he blowing that all out of the water? So, you know, he's a bit of a red herring like that, but also.
For our listeners and readers out there, kind of what his nickname Drip, what does that mean?
Oh, yes. So in the sports and music world, Drip is slang for being fashionable, extremely fashionable and trendy. Yeah. Someone who is, I don't know, our generation, we might say they're a dandy, right? Like, it's all about how they look and the best hair. They've got it all. They're all put together. And so if you've got it going on like that, then, you know, you've got some Drip.
You got it.
You
got it.
Yeah.
And so we know that this is important to him.
He's a cool guy.
He's
really
a very cool guy.
We like him.
Yeah. Yeah. We would love to see more of him.
Drip.
How about her brother, Bernard.
Yes. So Bernard uses sarcasm and cynicism as his sword and shield, doesn't he? He really, is a damaged soul from their childhood and they don't share a lot. They sort of, you know, had these sort of two separate upbringings, mm-hmm. but they do share a household that was really sort of torn apart. And so he clearly deals with it in a, he's hilarious. He's funny. He uses his sarcasm and cynicism, like his timing yeah. is wonderful, but there's anger behind that.
There is.
You really
there is.
Sense that he's got some healing to yeah. do. And even though he had his people yeah. and he sort of had the same sort of guardians yeah. and protectors like Bella did, I don't think they quite prepared him to heal as well as the yeah. grandmothers
yeah.
did.
Yeah. 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 We're going to talk, we're going to get throw out one more name and then we're going to take a very, another very short break. Tell us about yeah. Ellen.
Ellen.
Mm-hmm.
So Ellen is a bit of a surrogate. She, yeah. I like to think of, first of all, other than the surrogacy, I like to think of Edie, the mother, and Ellen as sort of the vehicles for the villain yeah. in the story. They're not the villain. Ellen's not right. the villain in this story, but she's a vehicle, which is really mental health. Illness. Mm-hmm. And so she and Edie are that. But also Ellen is this unexpected ally. Mm-hmm. And really, yeah. Bella turns her into that. She's quite intentional about yeah. Bringing yeah. Ellen to what she knows. Yeah. But the unexpected relationship that develops there is quite lovely. And really, Ellen saves the day, doesn't she?
She does. Yes. Mm-hmm. And that community garden yeah. and Ellen, you know, the whole, yeah. again, tying that the health, our health and garden health and is brilliantly woven together. And you don't really see yeah. it coming. It's very deft. It's very subtle. And then you kind of go like, okay, I think I need to go out and garden.
I need to get outside and get my hands dirty.
And we're talking with our special yeah. guest, Gina Carroll. We're talking about her book, The Grandest Garden. We're going to just step away for a moment. We are so happy to have a sponsor for this program, Blue Cottage Agency. Yeah. And we're going to just hear a little word from them, and then we'll be right back. Okay. So don't go away. Rendezvous with a Writer is sponsored by Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison, your author publicity and book marketing team. Experience, trusted, effective. Contact them today at bluecottageagency.com.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer with special guest Gina L. Carroll, and we're talking about a book, The Grandest Garden.
And I can't believe how fast the time is flying, Gina. So we're going to get to Jim's favorite question.
Yes.
What is it, Jim?
These great characters, do any of them ever surprise you?
Yes. All the time. As I say, Drip came in for a specific purpose, and then he became this character that I didn't expect. There are some scenes that were, you know, I went in to write them in a certain direction and they ended up in a completely different direction. I think one of those is when Bella and Bradford, he shows up at her door and that did not end well. And that was not originally intended.
That wasn't planned.
That was not planned.
Really, it's one of the funnest parts of writing fiction yeah. in this way, that you have an intention and you sort of, as you try to develop the character, they start to assert themselves and it's very cool.
Yeah. You mentioned that you were working on a handout for book club readers. And you also have something called the sort of 7 features of the story that are not fiction. And we don't really want you to yes. share that with us. But if you are listening, and this would be a wonderful book for a book club, you want to just hit a little bit on those tools that might be available and how they would get them?
Yes. That book club discussion packet is going to be available on my website. GinaCarroll.com very soon, end of this week. and it's with a graphics person. And it's just going to be lovely. And so I'm very excited about it. Yeah. I love book clubs. Yeah. Invite me. I'll fly to a book club meeting because I've had wonderful experiences with book clubs myself as a reader. And I just love them. And I love them just like this conversation with you is so lovely because I never know what you'll love and what will be significant. So it's always a really wonderful experience.
Tell us again, where they can find you. Yeah.
Yes. GinaCarroll.com is my website and all things, The Grandest Garden is there. And my other books as well. The Places Where I'll Be Next is there. Some of my tools for writers is there. So that's a great place to go. One of my favorite social media places is Instagram. I'm an Instagram person. And I'll tell you, I'm fairly new to Bookstagram because Bookstagram got a hold of my book and the experience has been amazing.
Wow.
So I'm kind of easy to find on Instagram at Gina Stories.
Jim has a quote.
Do we have a quote?
I'm looking at our time. Oh, my goodness. Okay, what you got there, Jim?
Well, the first quote, I got three, actually. And the first one is for the book. I always want to get a quote from the author's book. And this is from Bella. This is not long after Bella has arrived in New York. The landscape in the East Village along its orderly blocks was in a deep winter sleep. The small plots of dirt along the street were as hard and unyielding as the concrete, and the tree branches hung low like the arms of naked maidens. I've never heard trees described that way.
He had to read that aloud to be like, listen to this.
Awesome. Yeah.
Now, this is from a lady by the name of Elizabeth Lawrence. She was the first woman landscape architect at North Carolina State University in 1932. There is a garden in every childhood, an enchanted place where colors are brighter, the air softer, and the morning more fragrant than ever before. From the actress Audrey Hepburn, to plant a garden is to dream of tomorrow.
Oh, I love that. That's right.
We'd rather pick them to match what you've done.
Yeah. We just love this book. Again, we've been talking with Gina Carroll and the name of the book, and you absolutely have got to get it for yourself and for anyone in your around you. Just everyone should read the book, The Grandest Garden. And we thank you so much, Gina, for being with us tonight. We thank LA Talk Radio. We thank Hawk Texas Swing Band. We thank Blue Cottage Agency. We thank Sam Hassan. Join us next week when our guest is Mark L. Redmond. We'll be talking about his newest title, The Box M Gang. Very fun read. You won't want to miss that. And Jim, do you have anything else to share?
Well, as we wrap up, we always say it's a great day out west.
Keep writing, and we'll keep reading.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. We had a great time.
Thank you.